welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Imagine you're a kid and you do something wrong. Maybe you shoplift. Maybe you smoke pot or cut class. Maybe you get into a fight and hurt someone. What should the response be? That's the fundamental question we're going to discuss today. What should the response be when young people misbehave or break the law? And as we talk about this, I want to ask you to imagine we're talking about you or about your kid. No country incarcerates a higher percentage of its population than the United States. There are 2.3 million men and women living behind bars. But a lesser known fact is that the U.S. also has the highest number of young people housed in juvenile jails. California spends $88,000 per year to incarcerate a young person in a state facility, which is more than eight times what we invest in education. I'll fact check that with Nell in just a moment. In her new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, award-winning journalist and author Nell Bernstein writes that the story of the juvenile system is often told in terms of pendulum swings between the opposing goals of rehabilitation and punishment. But Bernstein says our approach to dealing with troubled children is not just wrong-headed and cruel, it's also demonstrably counterproductive. Welcome, Nell. It's good to have you here. So how would you describe the juvenile justice system around the country and in California today? Can you just kind of paint us a picture of what we're talking about?
Yeah,
and what the differences are?
That's a big question, because the juvenile justice system encompasses everything from parole and probation to tickets to community-based interventions to local juvenile halls. My book focuses on the large state-run prison-like facilities, which I call juvenile prisons because none of the euphemisms that we use for them seems accurate once you see them.
So what we do use euphemisms for them because there has been a move toward trying to create a more therapeutic atmosphere rather than punitive.
Well, you know, that's a common perception, but the founding premise of the juvenile court was that we should not be incarcerating children. We shouldn't be incarcerating them with adults, and we shouldn't be locking them up to punish them. That instead, we should be coming up with interventions in their own best interest. So that's where a lot of the language and a kind of a dual way of talking about what goes on comes from. But even going back to the 1800s, a rehabilitative system has never been the reality.
And so how did we end up putting kids in prison on such a widespread basis? Can you talk about a little bit of the history of juvenile prisons, how we got here?
Yeah. I mean, the first juvenile institutions were called houses of refuge, and those grew out of waves of immigration. So juvenile incarceration has always been targeted to particular racial or ethnic groups. Now it's primarily affecting black and brown youth. In the 1800s, it was the children of Irish and German immigrants. So we started doing it before we had a legal justification. And then around the turn of the century, we created a formal juvenile court that processed kids and made decisions about their future without granting them the protections of the Constitution, again, under this idea that the state was sort of a benevolent parent.
But you say the state is not a benevolent parent.
No. I mean, for a couple of reasons, I have completed my reporting with a much stronger view than I entered. I had assumed that I would look at this system and probably make some recommendations for reform. But what I found, both in my interviews with kids all around the country, my visits to juvenile prisons in a number of states, the kids I've known for 10 or 20 years who've been through these, and the mountains of research that we've generated, is that incarceration per se is not only an ineffective intervention, it's criminogenic. In fact, the greatest predictor that...
Criminogenic meaning that it creates criminals.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, this may not be a term that...
No, that's good.
I'm certainly not.
Not a sociologist, but the greatest predictor, it turns out, that a young person will wind up in adult prison more than family dysfunction, gang involvement, drug addiction, anything, is juvenile incarceration. Juvenile incarceration, when you control for everything else, including the delinquent act that led to it, doubles the chance that a kid is going to wind up as an adult criminal.
Well, and why don't you talk about what these delinquent acts are that lead kids into this system? Because I think that the common perception, and one of the problems with this system, is that these are kids that are locked away and you don't see them. But the perception is, well, these are the murderers, the violent criminals that are making the streets unsafe. But that's not what you found.
No, it's never been the case. But since we started transferring juveniles to adult court, you know, for whatever you think about this, those who have caused real harm tend to be in adult jails and prisons. And that's created a sort of inflationary effect within the juvenile justice system, where to fill existing beds and justify its own existence, they've had to lock up young people for increasingly minor offenses. I think the one that's being talked about the most right now is what's referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline. So things like carving graffiti into your desk, or getting into a fight, or truancy, or even being late to school that would have been dealt with a decade ago by the principal are now being dealt with by the police.
And so tell us what, when you're talking about a juvenile prison, so this is where kids are locked up for more than 6 months and often years and years, what does it look like?
Yeah. So again, this is why I use the word prison. It's not a ranch. It's not a boys' academy. It's not a school for girls. You drive in most states out into the middle of nowhere, because we site them in remote rural areas that need the jobs. The first thing that you see is coils of razor wire, just as you would outside an adult prison. And you asked people in your introduction to think of their kids. I'd like to ask people, as I describe this, to imagine it through the eyes of a 14, 15, or even 10-year-old. I've met 10-year-olds who were sent to these facilities seeing it for the first time. So there's the razor wire, there's a sally port, there's gates clanging opened and closed. There's kids being transported in the more secure units with shackles and leg irons. Even in the regular security units, they're marching military style, sometimes doing the chicken walk, which means crossing your arms across your chest and putting your hands under your elbows. And then there are cells. And this was another sort of linguistic struggle that I had. I was sort of corrected many times for using the word cells and told that these were children's rooms, but they're, you know, 9 by 11 at most. They have a cement bunk and a metal toilet. And sometimes that's it. Sometimes there's a desk or a few photos allowed.
Now, here in California, the juvenile prison system was called the CYA, the California Youth Authority, and at one time it housed thousands of young people in these facilities, where you had young people as old as 25. You would age out at 25. And in your book, you do tell the story of one 10-year-old who's here in this juvenile prison with, you know, men. Mm-hmm. But in California, there's been this big movement to reduce that population and essentially to shut down the juvenile prison system. So can you talk about what happened here in California, where I think that there's only a few hundred kids and that are still locked up in
there? When there were more than 10,000 to start. And what's happened in California is in some ways more extreme, but it does mirror a national trend. We've seen a 40% drop over the course of a decade in the number of young people incarcerated nationwide. So something is up. What varies from state to state, to some degree, I think, is the motivator. I sort of found a recipe for shutting down juvenile prisons, and it involved a scandal exposed by the media, investigated by the Department of Justice, a lawsuit, advocates, often family members or young people themselves, all of these ingredients exist very powerfully in California, and then inevitably a state budget crisis. So for me, the real question in a state like California, where there's been a stunning drop, is whether that's values-based or driven by federal mandates and financial crises. Because I think that's going to determine what happens to the kids who have now been handed back to the counties.
And what does a county juvenile hall look like, and how does that compare to what you're calling a juvenile prison?
You know, county juvenile halls vary. Sometimes they're worse. They're not sort of massive in the same way, but very often kids do stay in cells, and they may actually be in their cells for a greater portion of the day than in a state facility because there's not as much programming and such. But with some exceptions, the ones that I've visited have really been smaller versions. You know, you go into Alameda Juvenile Hall, and the first thing you see is signs on the walls that say this institution uses pepper spray. You see kids kind of pressed against the windows of cells.
And so what's it like? What's a typical day like for a young person in one of these institutions? I mean, you've talked with dozens and dozens and dozens of kids. What do they tell you?
You know, it's a funny combination of fear, because there is violence inside these institutions, not only among the youth, but a tremendous amount of very well-documented abuse on the part of guards. For instance, 12% of kids have been sexually abused. And I think that, you know, we know that. We make don't drop the soap jokes. But what we don't know is that out of that 12%, 10% have been sexually abused by guards. That's 1 in 10 kids. About a third have experienced either assault or a severe or injurious physical restraint. So there's this fear, what's going to happen? And then underlying that, there's this tremendous boredom. That was what I hadn't expected. You know, you walk into a day room, which is the recreation area, and you see these kids just sort of slumped over these little plastic chairs. For some reason, the chairs are always too small, and the Nature Channel always seems to be on. And there's just this sense that the kids are almost in hibernation, and it's so different as a parent of teenagers myself from any other environment where young people congregate. It's almost as if the life has been drained out of them.
And what do we know about, I mean, these are young people, adolescents who are in development. What do we know about the effect of isolation and incarceration on the development of young people's brains and bodies?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just to frame the answer, it turns out in confidential interviews that 80 to 90% of all American teenagers acknowledge having done something that technically could place them behind bars. So I think that we have a notion that there's...
I know that I have. Yeah.
I thought I was good, but it turns out I'm a chronic loiterer. I mean, based on where you live and what color your skin is, what defines you as a delinquent is just radically different. But thank you for saying that. And I'm going to ask you after the show.
I'm not telling anybody. I think the statute of limitations has run out. But most people have committed some offense.
Yeah, and we know that. And yet we don't kind of connect that with what gets kids in juvenile hall. But it's not any different. And the developmental needs of the kids who are locked up for these things that we all do are no different than any other kids either. I mean, if you think of the major developmental challenges of adolescence, they're forming close relationships, beginning to take responsibility for yourself, making decisions, which includes making mistakes, figuring out who you are. So if you're in an environment where all of your close relationships have been essentially severed, there's not much of an opportunity to form new ones. Trust is considered a very dangerous commodity. And you don't get to make a single decision from when you brush your teeth to what you eat for dinner. And then, as you said, you're pitched out at sometimes 24 or 25. You look like an adult. You have all the responsibilities of an adult, but you haven't had the chance to develop the capacities of an adult.
I've heard people who've been incarcerated long-term talk about it as institutionalized, an institutionalized brain. I've heard kids in the foster system talk about that as well.
Yeah, they talk about it all the time with tremendous sadness. You know, brilliant young man who worked as my research assistant on the book and had spent 6 years in the youth authority talked about coming out and thinking that he was going to be free and then discovering that he had sort of brought a prison with him. He wasn't comfortable if there wasn't somebody watching him at all times because he'd been in this panopticon through his developing years.
What's a panopticon?
Oh, I think it's a Foucault word.
Sorry.
But it's an environment where everything that you do can be seen from all around.
Okay, gotcha, yeah.
So there's no privacy. And needing to be told what to do. And he went on to college where the things that would allow him to succeed, like questioning things, making his own decisions, critical thinking, had all been sort of trained out of him, and he had to do some unlearning before he could begin learning.
If you're just joining us, I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call, and we're speaking with Nell Bernstein. She's a journalist and author of the new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. And we're talking about juvenile jails and prisons. And I want to invite you to join our conversation, especially if you were locked up as a young person. Tell us what it was like, what effect it had on you. Did it help? What would have helped? We're going to move into what are effective interventions in a moment. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Especially if you were in one of the state facilities like the CYA back when it was a robust system with thousands of kids in it, we'd love to hear about your experience. And if you're somebody who works with kids that are considered at risk, what kinds of interventions do you see work? What do you think is the effectiveness of incarceration? And if you work in juvenile justice, if you work at Alameda County Facility or San Francisco, call us and weigh in. Nell Bernstein is saying that the system is really so broken that it needs to be scrapped altogether, that kids should not be in juvenile prisons for the most part. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So you were just talking about kind of the effect of incarceration on a developing brain. And one of the things that you said that's hard in this atmosphere of fear and boredom is to develop trusting relationships, which is, you know, one of the fundamentals of being a human being. What is the relationship between adults and kids in these facilities like?
So I want to be careful about making generalizations, because for all the horror stories that I heard, I also heard stories of that one counselor, aka guard, who reached out and recognized somebody as a person. Sometimes it was a counselor. In one instance, it was a janitor who a kid in long-term solitary confinement said had saved his life by treating him like a human being and listening to him. So, you know, I do think that, and this confuses me a little, I haven't resolved it. People don't go into this line of work to beat up kids. Most of those I met went into the line, into the juvenile justice system to help kids. And yet somewhere along the way, the culture changes many of them too. And so you get people, I think with really good intentions, caught up in this brutality. So it's complicated.
So, but does it look like what the sort of relationship that you might see between guard and prisoner in an adult facility, or does it look more like, you know, teacher student, where there's an authoritative kind of a relationship, but it's much more of a relationship than?
You know, I think it's closer to the former, to the traditional guard-prisoner relationship. What's tricky is that along with the drop in population and the change in thinking that I think is happening nationally, a number of states are now trying to introduce therapeutic modalities into their prisons. So they'll have groups, they'll have, you know, behavior modification systems, and they make the claim that they're undergoing a wholesale renovation to become a therapeutic milieu. What I saw, for example, when I looked at a California facility that was in the middle of this transition was a lot of paradoxes. You know, one kid had been transferred from a facility near Los Angeles to one in the middle of the state, and he said, I'm in a family-focused therapeutic program, but I can't see my family anymore. Mm. They used to visit every weekend. Other kids would say, I'm supposed to open up in group to get better, but if I don't reveal as much as they want, or if what I say doesn't match my record, I can get a write-up, and that could extend my stay here. So, you know, whether or not those particular things are happening, I just think there's a paradox when you're asked to open up either to or in the context of this tremendous power differential. I mean, if you or I went to see a therapist, we would expect confidentiality, first of all, which kids who are incarcerated can't. And, you know, certainly we wouldn't expect to be punished for anything that we said. In fact, I think people pay for therapy to have a zone where they can say anything. And that can't happen inside a prison. So, no, as I said, there's always or often that one person that a kid will connect to. All the kids who made it described that kind of relationship. But I didn't see a close counselor relationship, no.
As kind of the general norm of adult-child relationships.
No, I mean, there's uniforms, there's pepper spray.
So we're going to go to a break in just a second. I'm going to get to calls. We've got some great people on the line that I want to get to. But very quickly, before we do, what system do you think, and I know you're saying burning down the house, that this is not an effective system overall, but where have you seen kind of these rays of hope in terms of where people are getting it right or reforming the system in ways that are positive and inspiring?
So the natural answer to that is Missouri. And everybody is now trying to imitate the Missouri model. It was very impressive. The facilities are small, 35, 40 kids. The culture is completely different. You do see those kind of genuine youth counselor relationships. But ultimately, the thing that has been shown to work best has better rates of non-recidivism than Missouri and better outcomes across the board are what are known as the evidence-based interventions, like multisystemic therapy and functional family therapy. And even with quite serious offenders, these interventions, which allow the kid to remain at home, assign him a caseworker who may be available around the clock, connect him and his family to community resources, they're what work, because the kid goes back to the family.
All right, and goes back to our communities in almost all cases, and we'll talk more about that after a short break. We're speaking with Nell Bernstein. Her book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Or you can also post your question or comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. The email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say, following that today at noon, Ira Glass and This American Life, here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
for those of you joining us now, we're talking about juvenile justice and the effects of incarcerating children. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. My guest is Nell Bernstein, author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Bernstein says the effects of incarcerating kids are so devastating and counterproductive that we need to scrap the entire system and start anew. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, especially if you're somebody who works in the system, in a juvenile hall, or in juvenile justice. We want to hear about your experience and what you think of what Nell is saying. And if you're one of the young people who's been incarcerated, let us know what your experience was like. You can even call anonymously. Again, the number is 866-798-8255. And let's go now to callers now. Let's go to Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan. Welcome to Your Call. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, and thank you so much for shedding a light on the system. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks to Nell. Go ahead, Susan.
So.
Tell us about your experience.
I am a juvenile offender mediator with Victim Offender Reparation Programming in the Bay Area. And basically what we're trying to do, even though it's a victim's rights-based program, an alternative dispute resolution program, something they call ADR option within the court system, it does give a huge voice to incarcerated and detained youth. It gives them a chance to step up and atone, apologize, address, acknowledge all the things that they often don't get a chance to do when they are in the system. And we find that this program, at its very best, begins in the elementary school grades, because that's where you want conflict resolution to start, how you lay down your weaponry, whether it's verbal or otherwise. When we don't get to address the youth in K-5, which is where a lot of this stuff happens, where kids, as you all both know probably from this important discussion, when kids fall off the school radar, they show up in the system very often.
Yeah, well, what Nell referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline, which is
exactly
increasingly talked about. Yeah.
Well, and what I think is so powerful about the work that you're doing and other models like it, including restorative justice models, is that there is space for the victim. I mean, I think people see that as counterposing. You're either going to help the victim or help the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
But
often,
you know,
the victim and the perpetrator are inseparable. You know, one is the other. The victims is, so often the offenders have been victims long before they lash out.
Well, that's absolutely true. The level of trauma is very high. But even in a traditional court case, I was just explaining this to my son last night. It's the state of California versus Joe criminal. It's really not for the victim. And
it's not me who was mugged. Necessarily, yeah.
Yeah, and I have met and have been crime victims who feel kind of let down. They're promised closure if the perpetrator is punished harshly enough, and really don't get that. So I'm glad you brought this model up. I think it's an important one.
And is there anything else that you can tell us about what you're doing in San Mateo, reforms that you've seen, the evolution of how the system's working, Susan?
Yes, well, I would say that since San Mateo has been a very, very supportive county, putting, not unlike San Francisco, many services inside the juvenile halls, including very important educational systems. Woodside Learning Center, for example, at San Francisco's juvenile hall, has some extraordinarily visionary and progressive people helping in education. But until the children have a chance to have a voice and to help settle for themselves some of the scores that will be continuing to ratchet up against them as they perhaps don't come out of the system, or worse, they come out and they carry the trauma and also the labeling of what they've done with them, then without a voice and without able to answer questions that the victim would want to ask of them, they go back into the old patterns, or they go back into the same branding. We have found on the school campuses right now, the SRO officers, the special resource officers, who are often, you know, San Francisco and San Mateo police, are serving as those therapists and those counselors who are helping to redirect some of the anger issues on the campuses. But so many of our referrals now are coming from principals and schools and police officers to the courts in terms of the children they feel they can't handle anymore for things that in our generation, maybe 2 decades ago, wouldn't have been considered offenses that needed to go through the court system but now are going through the court system. artwork that's problematic for a teacher, a penknife left mistakenly in a pocket, an anger issue left over from the morning at the kitchen table that's acted out in the gym. We're getting all of these kids showing up at juvenile hall now, and we're putting them through restorative justice options so they aren't, you know, detained for too long and then becoming worse than they were when they came in.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Susan. Really great to hear from you. Let's go to Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. This is really a great topic, you know. This is something I've thought about on and off for a long time because, you know, I have a friend. I'm 47 years old. I have a disabled friend, 37, and she has a 14-year-old daughter, and, you know, her and her daughter always had the best relationships, and long story short, her daughter had, like, ran away and been, you know, living on the streets, camping out under bridges, shooting dope. And she's a bit of a success story. My friend shot out a bunch of money for her to go to a drug and alcohol rehab program up in Oregon, and she's come back to visit actually this last weekend. And for the meantime, she seems to be doing pretty good.
Andrea, I'm just, because of time, I'm going to ask you to ask a question or get to the point a little more quickly, because we've got so many people who want to join us.
Yeah, one thing that disturbs me, I've seen a thing on the A&E channel, and you see these youth kids coming in shackles and chains, and they have these, like, older prison prisoners yelling in their faces and screaming at them, and, you know, what's going to happen to you? You come in here, you're going to be my bitch, blah, blah, blah. And I just think that that's so inappropriate and so counterproductive, and I think that it would make these youth a lot worse off. I think they could do something like use, maybe get them sitting down, trying to use, like, art therapy like they do with toddlers.
Gotcha. Well, let's hear a little bit more from Nell. Thank you so much for calling, Andrea. Let's hear a little bit more from Nell about what are effective interventions.
Well, I think that we talked about some of them, but, you know, it's interesting when you asked about relationships. One thing that interested me was people like the 10-year-old who was locked up with 24 and 25-year-olds, or another young man I know who was sent to San Quentin at 15, feared this kind of thing that they show on television, but in fact found that the older guys looked out for them in a lot of cases and were the mentor, the kind of the guy who was saying, don't go down my path. But, you know, the only thing that has really been shown to be effective are these programs that work with kids in the context of their home and of their family. And I have to say,
so taking them away from their family, which is the way that incarceration works, is not effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why I despair of reform. That even if we cleaned these places up and there was no abuse and great programming, the severing of existing relationships is not only profoundly traumatic, it ignores the fact that kids come from families and return to families. And if we're not dealing with whatever the root issue is, there's just no reason to expect a different outcome. And even the, you know, this business about the schools using law enforcement for minor infractions is in some ways a symptom of the overuse of incarceration. For example, you know, I think the national average is $88,000 a year to keep a kid locked up versus $10,000 a year to educate that kid. In California, it got as high as $225,000 a year, in great part because of the costs of ongoing litigation. And education spending dropped to something over $8,000 per kid. So then the school gets under-resourced, overcrowded, and what do? They call the police to ease their load. So it really is a vicious cycle.
Well, and it's a vicious cycle that affects largely poor kids of color. I remember a conversation with the former sheriff of San Francisco, Sheriff Hennessy, who said, when middle-class kids act up, we get them help. When poor kids act up, we send them to jail. Mm-hmm. And that's just fundamentally problematic. And that's what's happening. Let's hear from Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for this topic, very important. I have one thing I just wanted to put out there, and that is, I think that these young people, if they have to be where they are, maybe one thing that could help them some is if they could have kitchen duty, like on a rotating basis, because as you were speaking of, that they can't make any decisions, you know, about food. But maybe at least if they get to be near it, maybe once a month or something like that for 4 days, then it's a different thing to be near food and have to work with it, which maybe could, you know, encourage them a little bit towards something else they can do when they come out of there.
Well, yeah. Thanks, Marie-Louise. Yeah, Nell's got a response.
Well, I mean, it makes me think some kids do have kitchen duty, but sometimes steal food, because a lot of the kids I talk to were hungry.
All the time. They're adolescents,
especially,
right?
The boys.
And you and I both have teenagers. They eat all the time.
Oh, my goodness. You know, there's the idea that a teenage boy can get by on 3 meals a day. So they become very sort of conscious about rationing their own food. Especially, I remember a very tall, rangy young man talking about the stretch between dinner at 5 and breakfast at 7 as being too long for somebody growing as rapidly as he was to go without food. So he would keep some of his dinner just to make it through the night. And kids aren't starving. It's just sort of that attitude of, we're not going to give you anything more than what you minimally need because you're not meant to be comfortable here.
And is that changing?
Not that I... You mean within existing facilities?
That these are adolescents, growing adolescents, who maybe need a lot more food than...
You know, I mean, I think that the diet, again, varies from state to state. I haven't heard of real changes on that front.
Let's go to more callers. Let's go to Bibi in Oakland. Hi, Bibi.
Hi. Thank you so much, Nell, for your work and for doing this program, Holly. I want to speak to the institutionalized side of this with an experience that I had in Cambridge, England, with a woman who was doing a small experimental program with severely institutionalized people who were mildly mentally handicapped. And we put them together in group homes and she had brought Gestalt therapy to Cambridge, and we used a Gestalt model with these people, and it was so successful. So I just want to speak to that high-touch, interactive gestalt that I think is something to be considered.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let's go to Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Your guest put it beautifully, but I want to flesh it out. And it's a follow-the-money type of situation. I've never been arrested. Maybe some definite privilege growing up that I wouldn't be, but not my kind. Same with my children. I've got a son that's an attorney now. But there were cases where they, you know, everybody could have been arrested and they wouldn't, or, you know, charged with something and it gets out of control. I look at the whole drug thing, and I look at the drug enforcement and what police are paid. And this is a very sensitive thing. The average patrolman in Berkeley at the 10-year mark costs about, I think, $150,000 a year when you get the base salary of about 70 to 80 plus overtime plus superior benefits that are above what the rest of the city workers make and frankly above what most people that are paying the taxes get. So you've got a system that has to feed itself to keep going, particularly in the drug area, and arrest people for reasons we know they probably don't need to be arrested for. It's victimless in many cases, except for the drug sellers that are kind of vicious. But the point is, we've got people in law enforcement protected by superior public sector unions that are getting paid an awful lot of money, and they're part of the cost, or the prison guard system.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
That's the thing that really makes me angry.
Right, and it's the question of, if you build it, do you have to fill it continually? I imagine that you have a lot to say about this.
Well, I think the money issue is central and can work both ways. In fact, it's one of the things that right now is making me optimistic. Absolutely, there are a lot of people invested in the status quo. You know, I think it's widely known that California has a powerful guards union. And so things like the CYA population were seen as immovable. But two things happened. One, it got so overcrowded that the guards themselves were saying, we don't want laws that send more kids here. It's dangerous. But two, at a certain point, I used to call incarceration the last standing entitlement, because as we were cutting every other program from our state budgets, this was untouchable. But that's not true anymore.
And I've heard from some really enlightened law enforcement officials that talk about how fire departments changed the nature of what they did when fires were less widespread and became paramedics, et cetera, and that they can do that too.
Well, now there you go. That's a tricky one, because as the sort of what's in vogue moves towards a therapeutic model, some states are trying to retrain existing staff to be therapists and group leaders. And I do think that's a little more difficult.
And if you're just joining us, I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. Nell Bernstein is the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. I'm going to ask her about ending that this system in just a minute. But let's get a couple more callers. And if you want to join us, especially if you've been through the system, if you were a young person who was incarcerated, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And you can also post comments at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. You can put resources, ideas, and experiences there after this show. But let's go to Douglas in San Francisco. Hi, Douglas. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Thank you, Holly Nell, for putting on the show. It's an amazing topic to discuss. We've already talked about early intervention. I work for Huckleberry Youth Programs, and we run the Community Assessment Resource Center here in San Francisco, where a third of the youth who are arrested come into our program before going to the hall and hopefully prevent them from going to the hall. And it just seems like there's so many areas where we can intervene before we end up with people who are incarcerated, and we just got to take those opportunities whenever we can. What we've shown in our program is with psychotherapy, with a case manager, with just an adult sitting down with the youth and saying, hey, what's going on? Let's see if we can shift this trajectory a little bit. We've been able to reduce the recidivism rate of the people that come through our program. So I just want to say again, this is it's critical developmentally at this stage when kids are adolescents, especially when they're looking for who am I in the world? When we lock them up, that becomes who they are. When we give them other alternatives and connect them up to other resources, then they can actually become somebody else.
Yeah, and Doug, Douglas, that's what Nell is saying, is that what kids need is connection and relationships with caring adults. And a lot of the time kids who get in trouble, it's because a lot of the adults in their lives may have failed them.
You know, I also feel like what you said is just so crucial, that when you lock them up, that's who they become. And programs like yours that spare children even a week or a day in juvenile hall, I think can be life-changing, because even kids who've spent a very short period in that baggy uniform behind those bars will talk about being told, sometimes explicitly, you're a criminal. Only criminals are here. Welcome to the rest of your life. And whether that's verbalized or not, it's internalized. So the fact that you're intervening before they go through the gate, to me, it's just such a head start. And that's why I'm really on the fence about investing a lot in therapeutic programs within toxic institutions.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. In your book, you say at one point, I wanted to expose problems and fix them, but that just isn't possible in a system with power differential between captive and captor and adolescents' need for relationships. There's no way to fix it. It has to be shut down. I think I'm paraphrasing, but these were the notes that I took. And so can you talk about what you see as the change that needs to happen and how realistic that is?
Okay. Well, those are, I think, two different questions.
Okay.
But I think that, you know, as I said, even if we reformed everything we could reform, an isolation-based model just flies directly in the face of what we know as parents, as people, from research and from basic common sense, which is that relationship rehabilitates. Relationship is how children grow. You know, we're a country of family values, right? So I think any system that's predicated on isolating kids and severing relationships is just kind of set up for failure from the start. How optimistic am I? A 40% drop is significant, but we've seen it before. You know, in the 70s in Massachusetts, a guy named Jerome Miller came in and had the same realization. He wanted to reform the system, but faced so much resistance, including from his own staff, that he gave up on that and literally let everybody out, either into community programs that he put together very quickly or sometimes just sent them home. And the outcomes were very good. In the wake of that, 40 other states began to close their juvenile facilities, and it looked like we were on that path. And then in the mid-1990s, this mythical creature called
the predatory
super
thug.
Predator hit the scene, and that was all reversed.
But it does look like we're actually moving in the other direction right now, as you say, because of budget cuts and because of so much evidence, including what we're reading in your book, which is Burning Down the House, the End of Juvenile Prison.
It does, but I have to say, until we change our understanding of who the kids are, you mentioned racial disparities. I thought I would have a chapter on race. I don't, because it's in every single chapter of the book. Until we stop seeing the kids we lock up as other.
As these, you know, super predators.
As super predators, and also that, you know, when we prick them, they don't bleed. You know, they're used to it. It's part of their culture. They don't suffer like our kids would. Until we really get to know the kids and understand that, just like the 80 to 90% of all kids who are committing offenses, that there's not a difference.
And
until we have change spurred by that kind of change in thinking about the kids, I don't know that we'll have lasting change.
That we think of all kids as our kids, and that we know these kids. Let's go to Stephen in Hayward. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to your call.
Yeah, hey, thank you very much. I'd just like to add one little piece of the puzzle here so people could get a little bit of a perspective. I've been 14 years as a licensed marriage and family therapist and a school counselor. I've been laid off 5 times in 14 years due to budget cuts. There is no mandate in the state of California for having any counselors in any schools, and we are the first people to get laid off because we're very expensive to have. And I'm not saying that most school counselors are even trained to do therapy. Sometimes we're just used as clerks, basically, to do scheduling. But that's a piece of the problem, is until these school counseling positions are in place and they're mandated by law, the districts will cut them, as they continually have, versus, say, a speech therapist, that they have to provide those services by federal law. So that's something to think about. It is part of the solution if we can put in place something in the school systems, but until it's mandated by law, it won't happen. That's my belief.
Well, thank you so much for that, Stephen. And as Stephen points out, these are the programs that are the first to get cut, the counseling services, the art programs, after-school programs, all of these kinds of interventions for kids who might be either experiencing trauma in their neighborhood or at home, or just having, you know, the ordinary problems adolescents have.
And so when a kid makes a troubling drawing or gets in a fight in gym class, you can't send that kid to the counselor. And again, that feeds into the over-reliance on police.
The criminalization of youth.
A vicious cycle. Yeah, that makes complete sense.
And you know, even setting aside the moral and ethical questions, just from a pragmatic standpoint of economics, it doesn't make any economic sense, given what you're talking about the costs, not just the human costs, but the actual financial costs of incarcerating somebody versus having school counselors.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, you mentioned, the caller mentioned federal law requiring things like speech therapy. I'm assuming that's maybe the Americans with Disabilities Act, which established rights for people with disabilities. But you don't really have very many rights as a kid. And that's one of the great ironies of the juvenile justice system. You don't have the same constitutional rights as an adult has. You don't have the right to a jury trial. And I just sort of wonder if people have asked me, is there a federal solution? And I do wonder if we were to establish some kind of a right to family, if that might take us part of the way there.
And we have more callers, but we only have about a minute left before we go, and you can continue this conversation online at yourcallradio.org. But now, what do you want to say? What do you want people to be thinking about as we end this program right now?
So I think there's two things. I think that if this makes sense to you, I would obviously like people to think about it when they vote and act politically and civically. But I think the other way that all of us can make a difference is watching ourselves as we walk down the street. You know, are we crossing the street when we see a group of black teenagers coming? Are we the purse clutchers, the elevator shrinkers? Because I think that on a really fundamental level, we are all implicated in the criminalization of this generation. So I think that if we start there, as one kid I know said, if I'm being too loud in the street, yell at me. Don't call the police.
And that's Nell Bernstein. She's an award-winning journalist and the author of the new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. She's a former Soros Justice Media Fellow and a winner of the White House Champion of Change Award. And thank you so much for joining us, Nell.
My great pleasure.
I appreciate everybody who called, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of you. Again, you can continue to comment and post resources. Tell us about your experience at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What are you reading this summer? On the next Your Call, we'll open the lines to get your recommendations for reading while on vacation or enjoying a long summer evening. Do you have a book you're looking forward to digging into? Do you have an all-time favorite everyone should know about or a new discovery you can't wait to share? If you're a parent, how are you inspiring your children to read, and what are the books your kids can't put down? Join our conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.